Welcome to New World Notes, a series that explores the gap between the America we want and the America they're trying to make us settle for, and how we the people can reestablish our commonwealth and reclaim our democracy. Edited by yours truly, Kenneth Doust. This week, the second and last part of our look at President John Fitzgerald Kennedy and the causes of his assassination on November 23, 1963, 45 years ago this year. Again, we'll let the great political analyst and speaker Michael Parenti do the heavy lifting, with more passages from a long speech he gave in 1993. Last week, we focused on the alleged lone gunman, Lee Harvey Oswald, who was obviously both a CIA asset and a convenient fall guy. Obvious now, to us that is, not so obvious then, to readers of the official report of the National Cover-Up Commission. Today we'll focus more on the structural and institutional forces that led to the Kennedy murder, particularly on what's been called the deep state, or the national security state. One large part of the national security state is the upper echelon of the military. Before Parenti begins, here's Gore Vidal recalling a conversation he had with JFK on the military early in JFK's presidency. Vidal tells this anecdote in mid-2000. He's been asked to compose an open letter to the next president, whoever that may be.
In August 1961, I visited President Kennedy at Hyannisport. The Berlin Wall was going up, and he was about to begin a big military buildup, reluctantly, or so he said, as he puffed on a cigar liberated by a friend from Castro's Cuba. Operation Mongoose was never very thorough. It should be noted in passing that Jack hated liberals more than he did conservatives. He used to say, no one can ever be liberal enough for the New York Post. This was a different era, of course. Well, he said, the New York Post should be happy now. Berlin's going to cost us at least $3.5 billion. So with this military buildup, we're going to have a $7 billion deficit this year. It's a lot of pump priming, said Kennedy. And then he scowled. He said, I hate the way that they throw money around over there at the Pentagon. It's not they, I said primly. It's you now. It's your administration. He told me the facts of life, and I repeat them now, Mr. President, as advice from the 35th to the, what number are you, Mr. President? Are you 42 or 43? The only way, said Kennedy, for a president to control the Pentagon would be if he spent the entire 4 years of his first term doing nothing else but investigating that mess, which means he really could do nothing else. Like getting elected, I added. He grinned, something like that. So I now propose, while there is still time, that the new president zero in on the links between corporate America and the military and rationalize as best you can the various procurement policies, particularly the Ronald Reagan Memorial Nuclear Shield. You should also leak to the American people certain Pentagon secrets. In 1995, we still had our missiles trained on 2,500 foreign targets. Today, to celebrate peace in the world, our missiles are trained on 3,000 foreign targets, of which 2,260 are in Russia, while the other targets are in China, already selected as our next world enemy, and of course, targets in the rogue states of Iran, Iraq, and North Korea. Although President Clinton has spoken eloquently of a reduction in such dangerous nuclear targeting, the Pentagon goes its merry way, making the world unsafe for everyone. Jack Kennedy very much enjoyed a book called 7 Days in May by Fletcher Neble. It tells how the military, under a jingo, plan a coup to take over the White House. No, I don't agree with Oliver Stone that the generals killed him. But there is somewhere out there And this is what is missing in our history. A watchdog that seems never to bark in the night. Yet the dog that doesn't bark is the one that should be guarding the house from burglars. In this case, the military-industrial complex that President Eisenhower famously warned us about.
Now here's Michael Parenti on the national security state and the large role it played in the murder of John F. Kennedy.
What are we trying to say is that along with government, we also have a thing called the state. And along with governance, along with policies, and along with those things, we have this other instrument, even in a democratic state. And that instrument, whether it's in democratic France, or democratic England, or democratic Germany, or democratic Italy, or democratic USA, or democratic Canada, and all these countries, all of them have these other instruments and agencies that act like a bunch of gangsters, that act repressively, that use surveillance, that use every dirty trick in the book, unequal enforcement of tax laws, name it. The bringing in of drugs into whole neighborhoods and communities, trumped up murder charges, assassination. And that you have in the middle of these democracies, you have the state within the state known as the national security state. And that state is capable of the most unspeakable crimes that you can think of. And those crimes are perpetrated against their own people. They're perpetrated against people all around the world. That is, we are dealing with a state that was engaged in domestic counterinsurgency, and it was more interested in having a population that was unorganized and demoralized than a population that was organized, that was effectively fighting for its democratic rights. Because if it's organized and it's effective and it's powerful, it will start making demands and start pursuing its interests, and it will start cutting in on the interests that those police and those coppers and those undercover people and those forces of military and law and order are dedicated to protecting the status quo, protecting those with property against those who don't have it. And by the way, for the last 1,000 years, we've had theorists who've made that point, except they make it proudly. Adam Smith said, as the divisions of property become increasingly unequal, it is more and more necessary to have a state to defend those who have property from those who do not. John Locke, the purpose of the state is to defend those who have property from those who do not. And throughout the world, dominant economic interests today have enlisted the efforts of assassins and torturers. As we talk at this moment, the CIA and other such agencies in this country and other countries have sponsored violence, torture, death squads, drugs, in scores of countries, from Zaire to Angola to Mozambique to El Salvador to Guatemala to Indonesia to East Timor, and you go on and on, all to Western Europe, to the USA, to Chicago and Detroit and Boston and New York. They have systematically targeted in many countries the clergy, the peasant leaders, intellectuals, journalists, student leaders, labor union leaders, workers, and any community activists and such. Tens of thousands have been murdered and assassinated to prevent social change, to destroy any kind of redistributive politics, any kind of government, any kind of social movement that is not willing to reduce its people to economic fodder. And with NAFTA, with the North American Free Trade Agreement, we now see the third worldization of the USA will continue full speed ahead. And what it is so compelling about the JFK assassination is how nakedly the gangster nature of the state is revealed. It is an awakening. And to know the truth about the JFK assassination is to create a delegitimating force that calls into question the entire state system and the entire social order it represents. Playing before mass audiences, the movie JFK did not finger a cabal of malevolent perpetrators, but in fact pointed the finger at the national security state itself as the murderer. Damage control. You know, back in 1978, the House Select Committee reported, in fact, after an investigation, that there was more than one assassin shooting Kennedy. And there, therefore, was a conspiracy. In response, the Washington Post immediately editorialized in 1978, quote, "Could it have been some other malcontent whom Mr. Oswald met casually? It gets better. It gets better with... Could not as many as 3 or 4 societal outcasts with no ties to any one organization have developed in some spontaneous way a common determination to express their alienation in the killing of President Kennedy? It is possible that 2 persons acting independently attempted to shoot the president at the very same time. It is possible. It's not at all likely. So sometimes those who deny conspiracies create the most convoluted fantasies of all.
Does the governor know who killed the fisherman on the lake last night? Was a cigarette boat come around the point like a bat out of hell, wasn't burning his lights. The cigarette boat's not even legal, the lake's too narrow to be going that fast. 2 fishermen sat in an old green John boat making one more cast. Full moon rising, big and pale, and that cigarette boat didn't even slow down. Throwing up a big old rooster tail, and it ran right through him with a sickening sound. Does the governor know who killed the fisherman? Does the governor know who killed the fisherman? With a rope and a hook, they got no leads and no suspects. State trooper says they're not even gonna look. Does the governor know who killed the fisherman? Had to been some fat captain. Cigarette boats, they cost money. You can't just anybody buy a boat like that. Does the governor know who killed the fisherman? They can't find a boat, they can't find a trailer. They were watching the ramps, big mistake. I bet you the farm, it's in somebody's boathouse. It never made the ramp and it's still on the lake. But try to get a warrant, dream all you want. You won't be searching any lakefront homes. Justice is blind to them that owns it. Money don't talk when it's one of their own. Money don't talk when it's one of their own. Money don't talk when it's one of their own. Does the governor know who killed the fisherman? Does the governor know who killed the fisherman? Does the governor know who killed the fisherman?
James McMurtry and a song about the governor. The song explores issues of class, power, violence, and the legal system. Borscht Belt comedian Joe E. Lewis, I think it was, famously said, "I've been rich and I've been poor." Believe me, rich is better. And being powerful is better than being powerless, I've heard. And powerless is how many of us have been feeling for a number of years. If you're an immigrant or a person of color or a poor person, powerless is probably a feeling with which you're well acquainted. If you're a middle-class heterosexual white male, your feeling of powerlessness is probably a new and anger-inducing experience. If you're a newly elected president, you're likely to discover right away that you don't have the power to put even a quarter of your plans in place. Kennedy, a sharp guy, realized that he was powerless to exert much control over the military, let alone over the whole shebang, the military, industrial, congressional, intelligence, business, and finance complex that controls not only the de jure state, but also the de facto state. The deep state, as Peter Dale Scott calls it. The national security state, as Parenti calls the same thing. The guys that had Kennedy killed tricked CIA asset Lee Harvey Oswald into being the short-lived fall guy and convinced Chief Justice Earl Warren not to turn over too many rocks in his search for Kennedy's killer. Or maybe Warren didn't need much convincing. Back to Parenti and his indictment of the pirates who are running the show and who are not averse to shooting a president or overthrowing a government even of an ally or killing 2.5 million Iraqi civilians in order to enhance their own power and fortune.
The evidence we do have, in fact, is that John Kennedy observed Cambodian neutrality and negotiated a ceasefire and coalition government in Laos, which the CIA refused to honor. They preferred to back a right-wing faction that continued the war. Chomsky says much about troop withdrawal. He just wrote a whole book on this, Camelot Revisited and all that. But he says very little about troop escalation, other than to offer Roger Hilsman's speculation that Kennedy might well have introduced U.S. troops, ground troops in South Vietnam. Maybe so, maybe not. In fact, the same Hilsman noted in the New York Times not long ago, and Chomsky doesn't note it, that in 1963, Kennedy was the only person in his administration who opposed the introduction of U.S. ground troops. He was the only thing preventing an escalation of the war. Forget the question of withdrawal or not withdrawal. He was a barrier in that sense. Whether or not there are certain left analysts who think Kennedy was or wasn't a progressive or a liberal and thinks that the CIA had no reason to kill him or other people had no reason to be dissatisfied him, the fact is, do they see it that way? You know, entrenched interests are notorious for not seeing the world the same way that left analysts do. In 1963, people in right-wing circles, including elements in various intelligence organizations, did not believe that Kennedy could be trusted with the nation's future. Now, some months ago on a San Francisco talk show, I heard a guy come on. It was on KGO, and he said, "I've never said this before. I never said it. It's the first time I'm saying it. But I worked for Army Intelligence. And in 1963, I was in Japan, and when he, and the accepted word around then was that Kennedy would be killed because he was messing too much with the intelligence community. And when word came of his death, we were, all I could hear were delighted comments like, 'We got the bastard.'" What JFK's enemies saw something, was what they saw was something different from what Chomsky and Coburn have seen. They fixed on Kennedy's refusal to provide air coverage, the Bay of Pigs, his refusal to go in with U.S. forces, his unwillingness to launch another invasion of Cuba, his no invasion guarantee to Khrushchev on Cuba, his atmospheric test ban treaty with Moscow, his American University speech calling for a reexamination of our Cold War attitudes toward the Soviet Union, his unwillingness to send ground forces in a massive form into Vietnam, his antitrust suit against General Electric, his fight with U.S. Steel over price increases, his challenge to the Federal Reserve Board, his warm reception at labor conventions, his call for racial equality and responsiveness to civil rights leaders, reluctant responsiveness, his talk of moving forward in a new frontier. Irwin Knoll shows he's flexible, though. He says he allows that the Warren Commission did a hasty, slipshod job of investigation. I disagree. The commission did a brilliant job of investigation. It sat for 51 long sessions over a period of several months, much longer than most major investigations. It compiled 26 volumes of testimony and evidence. It had the investigative resources of the FBI and CIA at its command. Far from being hasty and slipshod, it painstakingly crafted theories that moved toward its foreordained conclusion that Oswald was the assassin. It framed an argument and moved unfailingly to fulfill that argument. It failed to call witnesses who saw something different from what it wanted to hear, who not only heard, but who saw people on the grassy knoll shooting. It failed to call them. It ignored or reinterpreted what little conflicting testimony that did creep into its proceedings. All this took deliberate effort. It was carefully crafted, painstakingly. A hasty, slipshod investigation would show traces of randomness in its errors. Some would go this way, some would go that way. But the commission's distortions consistently move in the same direction in pursuit of a prefigured hypothesis. The U.S. public has not bought the official explanation. 78% say they believe there was a conspiracy. And both Chomsky and Coburn in The Nation, Chomsky in Z Magazine, and again in a letter in exchange with me, both of them dismiss that fact and point out the same identical analog. They point out that, in fact, over 70% of the people also believe in miracles. So, what does that prove? And what has that got to do with the question at hand? That people can have a stupid opinion about one thing doesn't mean they're stupid about everything. In fact, Chomsky and Coburn are themselves evidence of that. In any case, the comparison is between two different things. They're comparing the public's gullibility about miracles with the public's unwillingness to be gullible about the official line of it being fed and shoved in their faces for 30 years. That's not gullibility at all. Alexander Coburn and Noam Chomsky have told us that we must not reduce great developments in history to conspiracy, for then we lose sight of institution, class, and other systemic factors of American capitalism. I don't need them to tell me about systemic factors in American capitalism. I use a structural analysis in all my writings. But investigating the JFK conspiracy, we are not looking for an escape from something unpleasant and difficult. That's psychiatrist Noam Chomsky speaking. But we're hitting upon the nature of state power in what is supposedly to be a democracy. Conspiracy is not something that's in contradistinction to structural analysis. It is part of it. These guys will use conspiracy. They will use legitimacy. They will finance elections. They will use publicity campaigns. They will set up liberalish organizations. They will set up alternative trade union movements. They will use assassins and death squads. They will use every single conceivable thing there is. And this was one of the things they used. When they had someone who was giving them trouble, when they had someone who was standing in their path because he was a little too bright and too shiny, when they had an agenda to save Southeast Asia from communism, they would kill one of their own. And that is a tremendous revelation. It was a startling revelation to the American public to make them realize what kind of a gangster government and national security state we really have in this country and what it does around the world. A structuralist position should not discount the role of human agency in history. Institutions are not self-generating forces. The great continuities of corporate and class interests, that's Coburn's phrase, do not happen of their own accord like reified, disembodied social forces. Neither empires nor national security institutions come into existence in a fit of absent-mindedness, although the British elites used to say that. The British Empire was accumulated in a fit of absent-mindedness. Give me a break, as these guys plotted and killed and brought armies in and destroyed and bribed and murdered and lied and did all the things and plundered these countries and plundered them. Absent-minded? God knows when you focus your attention what you would do. There's a conscious interest being pursued here, and the evidence for it is the state itself. These things, these events are created by willfully intended policymakers who pursue specific interests. It is the essence of the state and the function of state institutions to act as conscious agents in recreating the conditions of politico-economic hegemony. That's what it's there for. That's what they're paid to do. To achieve their goals, state leaders, especially those within the national security state, will resort to every necessary form of mass manipulation, deception, and violence, even against one of their own, whom they have come to see as a liability. Conspiratorial action is not, brothers and sisters, is not something separate and exclusive of institutional presence. In fact, there's a constant interplay between the two. Thank you.
New World Notes comes to you from the spacious underground studios of WWUH-FM, a community service of the University of Hartford. The views expressed here are entirely my own, not those of anyone else connected with this station. Email kdowst@hotmail.com. Thanks to Maria Gilardin, TUC Radio, and the A. Infos Radio Project for making Parenti's 1993 talk available. Until next time, this is Kenneth Doust advising, remember the Maine, remember the Lusitania, remember the Liberty, remember the Reichstag fire, and remember the government-appointed 9/11 cover-up commission. And remember to tune in again next week. Ciao!